the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to this winter episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. It's our final blast before Christmas this year. And we're going to try to serve up a little of the Christmas spirit, too. What you're about to hear is brought to you by great listeners like Grant Gibson, Mary Gruber, Andrew Rush, and Kathleen Emmer. They all voluntarily subscribe to the Peter B. Collins Show, and I'm very grateful. If you can help and you're able, go to my website at peterbcollins.com and look for the links on the right-hand side. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. And what you're about to hear are excerpts from a recent broadcast of the syndicated Norman Goldman Show. My time is a little crunched in between subbing for Norm and tending to my holiday duties, so I'm going to bring you the excerpts from the Norman Goldman Show on Monday, the 20th of December, including interviews about the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell with Rick Jacobs of the Courage Campaign, Robert Perry on the latest news about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and how leaks happen. Also, we'll talk with Alan Collinge. He's an expert on student loans and wrote a book about it, and they are impacted by the recent failure of the Senate to pass the massive spending bill for the current calendar or fiscal year for the federal government. And then in our final segment, my old buddy, Dr. Elmo, checks in. He's the guy who sang the Christmas hit Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer, and you'll hear him on the scene on the East Coast as he taped an episode of Jimmy Fallon's late night show and did a bunch of other appearances in the New York and New Jersey area. And he's got a new iPhone app. He's got a new bluegrass Christmas CD. Lots going on. So you'll hear that in the final segment of today's podcast. And we're going to give Roy Rogers and Trigger the Day off and let you hear the full-length version of Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer at the end of the podcast. But, you know, Dr. Elmo has tons of other great Christmas tunes. Go to drelmo.com if you'd like to check them out. This is one of my all-time favorites from his catalog.
Old Saint Nick and Mrs. Claus decided just this year there won't be any Christmas. The feeling's just not here. Some kids get more than they need. Some are spoiled rotten. And when it comes to Christmas time, too many are forgotten. It will feel like Christmas to people everywhere. It will feel like Christmas when we all learn to share. So Santa said to Mrs. Claus, something's way off track. I can't get into Christmas until the spirit's back. If there was just a way we could get boys and girls to see Christmas is what's in our heart and not what's neath the tree. It will feel like Christmas to people everywhere. It will feel like Christmas when we all learn to share. Then all the kids said, Santa Claus, we have too many toys. We'd like to share our blessings with other girls and boys. Now it feels like Christmas to people everywhere. And it feels like Christmas because we learn to share. It will feel like Christmas to people everywhere. It will feel like Christmas when we all learn to share. And will it feel like Christmas when we've new things to wear? No, it will feel like Christmas when we all learn to share. And will it feel like Christmas when Dr. Elmo's on the air? Oh, yes, it will feel like Christmas, but we still should learn.
Topic A, as we kick off the show today, here on the program that serves justice. Well, a little justice has been developed for gays and lesbians who serve in the United States military, overcoming an amazing wave of...
Sounds a lot like latent homophobia to me.
Ah, yes, homophobia lives on.
Happens left and right.
There were four Democrats who voted against repeal and one who didn't vote.
We gotta stand and fight.
And the array of Republicans who you thought might have voted for repeal of the ban on gays serving openly in the military. Well, many of them did not. But fortunately, it did break the 60-vote cloture barrier and then ultimately did pass over the weekend. And joining us to talk about this is a man who has been crusading for human rights and civil rights for gays, lesbians, transgender, and bisexuals for quite some time. He heads up the Courage campaign here in California. Rick Jacobs, welcome to the Norman Goldman Show.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you on the radio, having seen you live just a week ago.
That's right, Rick. Well, this is certainly a very important step. But it's not the whole deal, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But first of all, after over 20 years of this awful compromise that was forced on Bill Clinton early in his first term, we're finally clearing the smoke and the BS of don't ask, don't tell. And tell me how you feel after all the work that you and others have done to push this.
Well, I feel, as you just said, I feel that we got a great victory. We're not done yet, but I also feel that it's very sad that we had to have this victory. It is a strange thing indeed in this country, in this day and age, that we are just now somehow allowing people to serve openly in the military.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as if the charade actually worked. I mean, when you hear people like John McCain, who has lost all credibility, of course, even before this debate, but when he tries to tell you that despite his wife and daughter are on the other side, that he's roping in one of his sons who served in the Marine Corps to say, well, it ain't broke, so don't fix it. But it is broken because more than 13,000 talented people who wanted to serve our country were forced out of the military, and some of these were people with critical language skills at a time when we were heading off into war in an area where, well, we don't speak the language, Rick.
Well, that's right, and one of them is very well known to people, Dan Choi, Lieutenant Dan Choi, who came out publicly on the Rachel Maddow Show in March of 2009. Dan is a fluent Arabic speaker and was kicked out of the military. Apparently, we don't need Arabic speakers in Iraq. Yeah, I'm very disappointed in John McCain, but I also have come to expect it. I mean, there's a man who 10 years ago was the maverick and actually was saying some things that were interesting. And then during the ensuing 10 years, I think I'm not really sure what's happened to him, but whatever it is, it's not rational.
Well, you know, he's kind of gone from slippery maverick to a just kind of sold out bottom feeder.
Well, that's very likely. 65 senators on Saturday voted to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Only, I think it was 31 voted against, maybe 33 voted against it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a remarkable statement. As you pointed out, I think it was five or six Republicans voted for repeal. This mm-hmm. is a bipartisan issue at this point. It's something that needs to get behind us. And I think that gets to the bigger point, which is the implementation of this could take a long time. And we at the Courage Campaign are working very, very hard to insist that the president and the administration not drag their feet on this. It's
well, and explain, Rick, because there's several steps here that have to occur before really people can come out and serve openly.
That's exactly right. The first step is on Wednesday, the president will sign the bill, and that'll be a day of celebration. The next step, though, is that the chiefs of staff of the military and the finally then the joint chief, the chairman of the joint chiefs, and the secretary of defense, and the president have to certify to Congress that all of the steps are in place in order for the repeal to be lifted, the ban to be lifted, excuse me. And then there's a 60-day waiting period for no particular reason, except that's what the late Senator Byrd insisted upon. And then the policy is implemented. Now, the sooner we can move and get this over with, the better off our country will be, the better off the military will be, and the better off society will be. Now, so we're going to keep pressing on that, and people can find out more about that at couragecampaign.org. We'll be pressing very hard that the feet not be dragged in this process, because it is only going to hurt people if a policy that is already deemed not a policy, if the laws change, it'll only hurt people if it drags on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one other point I want to make that has apparently upset some folks on the right, so I know it must be, which is that the military and public are the last two places in society where we really do have some sort of a melting pot, where different people from different backgrounds actually get together. And lifting the ban is going to allow gay and lesbian soldiers to serve openly with other normal people. We're all normal with everybody else. And the people will see that the prejudices that they have are archaic, and mm-hmm. they'll melt away. And I think that is the unheralded victory here, which is that America yet again is marching toward strength and diversity. And I'm very excited about that.
Well, and Rick, one of the things that I didn't watch all the debates, so forgive me if I'm casting an aspersion here that is unwarranted, but I have yet to hear any of these people who are so afraid of gays and lesbians serving openly talk about the real sexual problems in the military that affect unit cohesion and readiness and all those issues that we hear the right-wingers ramble on about, and that is out-of-control heterosexuals who are, we have the highest rate of rape of the women who are serving in the military, rape and sexual harassment, the sordid stories of command rape that have occurred in war zones and outside don't get much attention. There's a courageous woman named Colonel Anne Wright, who is a member of Code Pink and works on many other issues, but she's been focusing a lot on the sexual treatment of women in the military. And that's a much more crying problem, a problem crying out for attention, than any of the potential conflicts or discomfort that may have occurred with straights serving around gays.
I totally agree with you. And it is something that the military has to deal with. There's and you would think that some of these right-wing folks would care deeply about that. You know, it's been quite a year, 2010, in so many ways. But in one of the ways, it is quite a year for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender progress toward equality. And it began on January 11th in San Francisco in the federal courts there when Judge Vaughn Walker began hearing the case tried by Ted Olson and David Boies, that mm-hmm. ultimately he ruled on August 4th that Prop 8 was unconstitutional. And there have been other court cases as well this year that have been landmark. And then, of course, we end it with the lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, at least legislatively. Now, I mention all of that because that trial put to rest, for anybody who watched it, all of these false accusations and fears that people use to infect America with hatred and distrust toward each other.
Mm-hmm.
One of the points that was made in the trial by an expert named Dr. Nancy Cott from Harvard and Yale is that the women have only become equal in marriage, in law, and custom in marriage, but in law especially, since the 1970s in this country. Since the 1970s. It hasn't been that long.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we have these folks from the far right who really, frankly, seem to want to turn the clock back so that America would look a lot more like it looked maybe in the 50s or maybe even in the 30s. I mean, actually, they seem to resent the fact that women are beginning to be treated equally in society, and they equally resent the fact that other minorities, that gays and lesbians and other people are being treated equally, or starting to. We're not yet. And
So
I think that's a lot of what's going on here.
Well, Rick, I really appreciate the fight that you and others have carried on here. There's much more work to be done. We've got to get marriage equality. We've got to lift the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And we have to work one with another to really bring about real personal change. And I want to direct people to your website, couragecampaign.org. You're not a single-issue group. You work on a range of progressive issues. And one of them that I want people to know about is ISA Exposed. You're going to be monitoring Daryl Issa, the incoming chair of the House Government Oversight Committee. He appears gearing up to launch a lot of unnecessary investigations of Democrats in the Obama administration. And that's one of the things that I think you're ahead of the curve on. And I hope people will support ISA Exposed and the other work at couragecampaign.org.
Well, thank you so, so much. I really appreciate this, Peter, and appreciate the opportunity to be with you on this wonderful show. And I hope that as we do head into the quiet, relative quiet of the holidays and people look back, we see the great accomplishments of the year as well as the great challenges ahead on the economic front, on economic justice right here in this state of California, but across the country with people still being drummed out of their houses.
Yep.
And on full equality for everybody in the country. So, again, thanks for your leadership and thanks for having me on.
Rick Jacobs, couragecampaign.org. Your calls are next here. Grab a line and let's talk about the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. 888-321-6001 is our toll-free number. 888-321-6001. For Norman Goldman, this is Peter B. Collins. Well, over the weekend, we learned more about the private sexual affairs of Julian Assange, the leader of WikiLeaks. And he's now on a house arrest at an estate in England. He is wearing an electronic leash and has been issued some very heavy-duty condoms, I guess, in case he has any encounters while he's there. And I don't want to make light of sexual situations where women feel their rights are violated. But I have to say, from what I've read, and The Guardian UK published more than the New York Times did about the police file in Sweden, but it appears that this is a case of two groupies who both wanted a piece of this international rogue. I guess he's seen by some people, a hero by others. And they got it. Each one of them had a sexual encounter with him. And apparently Julian Assange doesn't like to wear condoms. He's not the only guy in the world. But that constitutes a potential violation in Sweden. And these two women discovered that each other had encounters with Assange, compared notes, and then went to the police and said, how do we do this? And their questions about how the charges were first dropped and then resuscitated, by whom and for what. But I see that as a sideshow. And the real issue here is that WikiLeaks has exposed the underbelly of America's foreign policies. And on a net basis, I applaud it. I think that we deserve to know much of this information. And the thing that we have to be most careful about is there's so much info that we could be spun through some information that they want us to see, and we might be distracted from other information that we ought to be seeing. We turn now to Robert Perry. He is a longtime Washington-based investigative reporter. He was on the front lines of the Iran-Contra story back in the 1980s. He's written extensively about the Bush family, and he started one of the first nonprofit journalism sites at consortiumnews.com. And Ray McGovern, who was on our show on Friday, who had been arrested at the White House on Thursday, he writes regularly, as many other great voices do, for consortiumnews.com. Bob Perry, welcome to our program today.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And I do just want to mention one more thing about Consortium News. Ray McGovern has a story about his experiences protesting at the White House in support of Private Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and the whole WikiLeaks episode. And he and over 100 others, mostly veterans, were arrested in their protest on Thursday, and we're still waiting for the corporate media to cover that story.
That's right. It's been sort of a non-story, even though some very prominent people, including Daniel Ellsberg, were among the people who were detained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you published a piece on December 16 at Consortium News about some of your own experiences with leaks and leakers. And first of all, we've got to say that Washington, D.C. is perhaps the most porous city on the planet when it comes to control of information. And when we look at the hierarchy of leaks, Bob, the most important, the most critical ones are official leaks. For example, all the stuff that Bob Woodward gets in his presidential books that he writes, those are often very strategic leaks. And we also had a powerful leak of the identity of our CIA chief in Pakistan, and he is being recalled as a result. And I hasten to add that his exposure has absolutely nothing to do with WikiLeaks. But leaks are prevalent and very hard to stop. Talk a little bit about the overview, and then we'll talk about some of your experiences with people who leaked information to you.
Well, I mean, back in the 1970s, when the Washington Press Corps was perhaps more aggressive than it is today, there was the tradition of the whistleblowers telling reporters things, obviously the case of the Watergate scandal, some of the secrets about the CIA's abuses. The Pentagon Papers, of course, was a major leak from Dan Ellsberg to the New York Times. And these were cases, though, of people who were stricken by conscience or feeling that they needed to alert the public about some problems, who came forward and often were given some protection by the news media to allow them information to come out confidentially. However, one of the results of that was that the government realized that people believe things more if they thought they were coming from these kinds of unnamed sources. So then you started seeing the government intentionally leaking information, telling reporters, you can't quote me on this.
Right.
Because if they'd gotten the same information from a government spokesman, nobody would believe it. But then they sort of started playing this game. So a lot of what we've seen in the last 20 years or so has been of that variety. The government officials intentionally putting out information, some of it false, as we saw during the run-up to the Iraq War. Some things like the exposure of Valerie Plame, the CIA officer whose husband criticized the Iraq War,
mm-hmm.
where the journalists are made sort of party to this, essentially a government effort to put out information to make a case, even if it's not real. Yet what we're now seeing with the WikiLeaks situation is more the traditional idea of someone, allegedly Bradley Manning, this young private, putting out information that he thinks the American people should see relating to how the government really functions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's fascinating to see the pushback on this and the effort to steer us. Look over here. Look over there. No serious problems have been caused. And Gates has been forced to admit that we really haven't compromised any very important assets or functions, and that to date there's been no loss of life directly attributable to WikiLeaks. Now, that notwithstanding, it does seem Eric Holder, the Attorney General, is tipping or at least teasing the idea, and Julian Assange has certainly bitten off on this tease, that there is a grand jury in Northern Virginia that is impaneled with the intention of indicting Julian Assange. Is there anything new on that, Bob?
Well, I think it's been reported now pretty widely that there is this grand jury. Attorney General Holder did say that there had been some significant development. He did not specifically say there was a grand jury, but he seemed to be pointing in that direction. And the idea seems to be to try to criminalize journalism, which is to say that the allegation would be that Assange conspired with Manning to get this information out.
Right.
And the distinction being made is that, well, if a journalist just sort of gets something passively and then uses it, that's one thing. That should be protected by the First Amendment. But if a journalist, you know, collaborates with the source in some way, then that should be an indictable offense.
And this is where you've written about some of your experiences where people who gave you classified information or accidentally gave you access to classified information, those are situations where under this new concept of Julian Assange's alleged offenses, you could have been indicted.
Well, I think it's a myth to think that reporters just sit there and open their mail and then find classified material or other sensitive stuff showing up. It doesn't really work that way, at least not very often. Mostly reporters are out there trying to convince some government official to tell them something, to confirm something, and to get the person to, in a sense, I guess, break the law, and that they may, the government official may have some legal requirement not to tell you something. But for the good of the public being informed about what the government does, especially areas of criminality, the job of a reporter, as we've traditionally seen it, is to try to get those secrets. Obviously, there are times when reporters and their editors decide not to go with all the details they get, but we still are trying to get that information for the American people. And we're often the instigators. This idea that it's okay if you just sort of passively receive things is kind of silly, because in almost virtually every case, maybe with a couple of exceptions that I was involved in the 1980s on Iran-Contra, I was the one trying to get the government official to give me something or tell me something.
Mm-hmm.
I was not innocent in that regard. And if you want to criminalize the process, you're going to really criminalize any investigative journalism dealing with national security.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I appreciate the piece you wrote. I want people to find it at consortiumnews.com. The headline reads, "Journalists Are All Julian Assange." And this is a very important issue about our free press, and it also weighs heavily on the Obama administration and the president's promise of transparency, because we've seen crackdowns on whistleblowers and expansion of secrecy under this president that, frankly, I didn't expect. Bob Perry, you can find him at consortiumnews.com. We saw the Obama cave-in on tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, extending the Bush tax cuts for 2 years, insanely, into the next election year. And with that, the very wealthy in this country got more money, and then their toadies in Washington turned around and blocked the Senate's consideration of this massive, what's called an omnibus spending bill. Now, I'm not a big fan of these big packages because there's so much in them that it's very hard for members to vote against a whole package because there's something they like in there. But it is, unfortunately, the way business is often done in Washington. But with the rejection of the omnibus spending bill, we now have a temporary patchwork situation where spending will continue under the old budget for the next couple of months. And then we have a new Congress with a Republican majority in the House and more conservative, including a Tea Party member or two in the Senate. And they've pledged to cut spending even further, despite what's happening across the country. We're hurting badly. The state of California is bleeding financially, and they're closing all the libraries.
They're closing all the libraries, they're closing all the libraries, they're closing all the libraries, locking hallowed doors. They're closing all the libraries, doubling my parking fees, they're building prisons in old schoolyards.
And not only that, across the country, public institutions of higher education are ratcheting up the cost of a college education at a time when families have lost their home equity and whatever they had in the stock market, and whatever college money they set aside may have been used to, oh, hold on to the house or pay health insurance premiums or other issues like that. Well, Alan Collinge joins us now, and I want to thank listener Kyle McCarthy. because he responded to my offer to consider suggestions from listeners. He sent me an email over the weekend. And Alan Kalinge is at studentloanjustice.org, and he is also an expert on this issue. He published a book a year and a half ago called The Student Loan Scam, subtitled The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. Alan, welcome to our program today.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and I think this is a very critical issue because we've had Republican governors and legislators all across the country say, you know, I held the line on taxes. We didn't raise taxes. But the cost to working families of a higher education has gone up exponentially in the last 5 years alone. And we couple that with the way student loans operate, and this has placed a huge burden on the future workforce of America. Give us a quick sketch of the dimensions. How much money is there?
You know, it actually goes back quite a lot further than 5 years. In fact, for the past 30 years or so, the price of college has risen at about double the consumer price index, or double the rate of inflation. And so, I mean, obviously you can't sustain that sort of increase in prices for too long before the line starts getting exponentially larger on the plot, and indeed that's what we're seeing here today. Just a couple of months ago, student loan debt nationally actually eclipsed credit card debt to take first place among all types of consumer debt, excluding real estate. So,
this is a big profit center to the banks that participate in the student loan pools, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The thing about this that is really painful and that people need to understand, this is a lot like the inflation that happened in the subprime home mortgage industry, but there's a key difference, and that is that for student loans, both public and private, there are no bankruptcy protections. In fact, student loans are the only type of loan in our nation's history to be specifically precluded from coverage under bankruptcy law.
Mm-hmm.
There was never any good reason for doing this, but for the lobbying strength of the student lending companies on the Hill and their banking lobbyists. But that is a fact, and this is causing just tremendous amounts of pain across the country, and it's the number one primary cause for the inflation that we've seen as well.
Now, Alan, we are at record low interest rates in this country. The prime rate is at zero or a point, and 30-year fixed mortgages for homeowners in the 5% range, at least here in California. What's the average interest rate on a student loan today?
Well, for private loans, which is what I was hoping to talk about with emphasis today, the average is about 12%, although that number is a little bit hard to pin down because of the proprietary nature of the debt. But for private loans, we've seen interest rates or APRs as high as 28%, actually.
Ow!
It's like the Wild West out there since they removed bankruptcy protections.
I mean, that's payday loan level extension for people who may not have a payday.
Oh, that's right. It's very, it's not only scary, but for the people who have co-signed on loans for their sons or daughters, maybe their grandsons, nephews, nieces, it really has become a threat to their financial health. That is the health of the entire family. And I am not kidding, and I can point you to examples if you'd like to talk to other guests. Of people who have literally lost their homes as a result of their sons or daughters, running afoul on these private loans.
Yeah.
And this is not nickel and dime stuff, Peter. This is financial ruin, potentially, for millions of citizens.
And are there any resources out there? Let's say that, you know, I finished college, I've got $200,000 in student loans, I'm making 50 grand a year. What kind of options do I have to stretch that out over a longer period of time or refinance it at a lower interest rate?
Well, there's two types of loans. There's federally guaranteed loans and private loans, so it's a little bit complicated. But
right.
In the case of private loans, currently, the borrowers have absolutely no leverage. They have no bargaining position with the lenders, and so they truly are at the mercy of the lenders. And so there's very little recourse for those borrowers. And so, too, for federal loans, there is very little recourse under the law because of this weird exemption from bankruptcy protection. Mm-hmm. But in the case of federal loans, there are some marginally good potentially payment plans that the borrower may qualify for.
Yeah.
But for all student loans, and listen, nobody wants to file for bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy laws have been strengthened significantly since 2005 to preclude, you know, fraud and abuse and you know, people trying to skate on their debt for no good reason. But not having bankruptcy protections, Peter, has given carte blanche to the industry to run ramshod over the lives and livelihoods of students and their families. And so, really, citizens need to stand up if they've gone to college or are planning to go to college, they have a family member planning to go to college. We really need to restore just common sense bankruptcy protections so that, you know, at the end of the day, there is at least some ultimate recourse for the borrowers. And this will help greatly to keep the cost of college in line, because right now the checks and balances are just completely out of whack.
We're talking with Alan Kolinge, the website studentloanjustice.org, his book entitled The Student Loan Scam. Now, Alan, what about the Pell Grants and this shelving of the omnibus budget? Will there be an impact there?
Well, my best guess is that they're going to play politics with Pell for a few months. When the Republicans get comfortable in their positions, ultimately they'll probably come around. I would not doubt for a minute that the Pell Grant funding would get cut, or possibly there could be some games played with the student loan interest subsidy, that they could trade one for the other or some such. But we can bet that the colleges will moderate their prices to match what Pell is, whatever it ends up being. This is what the colleges do. It's kind of an interesting game that they play. But my best guess is that Pell is probably not in any jeopardy, but it's not going to be like it was in years past.
And do you think there's a prospect that the Republicans will try to renegotiate some of the changes to the student loan programs that were enacted in the last year or two?
Well, I think the Republicans, and I think many Democrats, the Blue Dogs most notoriously, will all be looking to take the axe to, you know, whatever pot of money they can find to cut and point to without too much political backdraft or
pushback, I guess.
Well,
right, Alan. Well, thank you for the update. And again, my thanks to Kyle McCarthy for suggesting that we talk about this. I think it's a very important issue, well off the radar, and particularly
thank
for parents.
If I could maybe make a quick plug for defaultmovie.com. This is our documentary that's coming out on PBS later this fall.
Great. That'll be on TBS. And also, isn't there a show on CNBC that you're participating
we'll
in tomorrow?
Yeah, CNBC tomorrow night at 6 p.m., correct?
Okay, great. And there's more information. You bet. Good to talk to you, and I appreciate your work, Alan. Go to studentloanjustice.org, and again, his book is called The Student Loan Scam. It's the Norman Goldman Show, and I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Norm today. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct holiday pleasure to welcome to our program the guy who sold 12 million copies of this Christmas special song.
Here's the one that pays the rent. Grandma got run over by a reindeer. Walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe she'd been drinking too much eggnog.
That Christmas classic is now 31 years old, and Dr. Elmo is 36, so he's still going strong with a powerful Christmas tune, and he's traipsing along the East Coast this week, Dr. Elmo, welcome to the Norman Goldman Show.
Hey, thank you, Peter. It's great to be on the Norman Goldman Show, especially with you.
Well, cool. Now, are you still cruising around in Jimmy Fallon's limo?
Well, I just got out of Jimmy Fallon's limo, and I'm just calling you from a payphone here on the street in New York.
Is that how it works? Now, Elmo, give our listeners a quick sketch here, because you were in New York appearing on some local TV shows, and you got a call from Jimmy Fallon's people, and they made you an offer, and you've already taped the show that'll be broadcast tonight, and they pulled the limo just hours after you finished working?
Yes, they did. Well, you know, we were so amazed that we were on our way home yesterday, but then they called and said, we'd like to have you on.
Uh-huh. And how did it work out that you got to perform the grandma song with the Roots?
Well, they saw us perform it with a bluegrass band, and they said, you can bring that band if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
But we said, well, we'd like to play with the Roots. And it was an experience. I'm telling you, that playing with those guys was probably the best thing I've ever done.
Wow. Well, I can't wait to see it. I'm going to warm up the TiVo in case I don't stay awake late enough to see Jimmy Fallon.
All right.
And what part of the show do you appear on? That'll help me decide whether I can stay up that late or not.
Well, I'm at the end of the show.
Uh-huh. And yeah, do you get to sit on the couch and schmooze with Jimmy, too?
No, I did not. I just played the song, and Jimmy came out before I played the song and said a few nice words to me, and then I just played the song, and then that was it.
Did he have a story about his connection to the Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer song?
He did not, but he said that he really loved the song, you know, all his life, and he was really happy to have me come sing it.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's cool. And what else occurred on the show? Did they have a really fabulous green room, and did you, you know, grab any souvenirs?
They had, I have to tell you this, there was a girl who came out and met us, you know, from the limo. We were staying one block away from the hotel, and they got a limo to take us one block. So
that's living large.
Yes, it is. So this girl brings us in, and she, you know, she said, we walk in, I said, you know, I'm a runner. Something came up. She says, I'm a runner, too. And so we go in the green room, and there's a banjo and guitar, and there's all kinds of guitars hanging up all over the green room, instruments.
Wow. Uh-huh.
So I look at the banjo. I said, wow, there's a banjo there. And she says, I'm a banjo player. I'm thinking, you're a runner and a banjo player, and I'm a runner and a banjo player? They must have, like, groomed her for this day.
Wow.
So we sat down, she played the banjo, and I played the guitar, and we had a little jam session before we went out to play with the Roots.
And is she any good on the banjo?
She was very good on the banjo.
Because that's one of your great musical strengths.
It is, yeah, and I'm glad I had the guitar while she was playing banjo.
And then did you guys, like, do a couple of laps around the block just to see if she really is a runner?
Yes, we did, Peter. It was a little chilly for me.
Now, Elmo, I have to tell you that, you know, when I fill in on a talk show like this, we're not supposed to talk about the commercials and all that stuff. But yes, frankly, the commercial breaks are pretty long. And rather than nod off and fall asleep, I've been grabbing my iPhone and playing the Skeet Shoot Fruitcake game.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
And Elmo, I just had, about half an hour ago, I had my personal best. I got over 800 points.
No kidding. How many points do you get for hitting the goose?
Oh, hell, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I haven't figured all that out. But the Grandma's Fruitcake Skeet Shoot is a really fun game. And it also comes complete with a recipe for fruitcake that includes motor oil. Now,
yes.
I've heard of a lot of additives to fruitcake, but motor oil, really?
That's the most healthy ingredient in there.
Well, this iPhone app is a lot of fun, and it only cost me 99 cents, and I've gotten hours of pleasure out of it. There's also a game that is based on your song, Uncle Johnny's Glass Eye. And this is a song that gives some people kind of a creepy reaction at first. But I think it's a song for the times, again, because Uncle Johnny's Glass Eye is set in the Depression, and Uncle Johnny comes to visit, and he brought a Barlow knife for the kid who is the focus of the song. And then the kid, before Uncle Johnny got up in the morning, kind of grabbed the glass eye so that he could take a peek at the Christmas presents without actually, you know, getting caught taking a peek at the Christmas presents.
Yes.
And so the glass eye game is really cool. What kind of reaction have you been getting from people who've played it?
Well, a lot of people really like it. And I haven't learned how to aim the pitching machine. It has a baseball pitching machine, and you put the glass eye in there instead of a baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So, and but if you get good at the game, you can aim the pitching machine, and you can shoot it at the glass eyes at either a target that dunks Santa, and you can shoot it at reindeer or Santa or the sleigh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so it's a pretty fun game.
Well, I got to work up my skills on that one. I haven't played it quite as much. But next time I see you, you and I can practice with it, okay?
All right. Yeah, we're going to work on it together. We can compete.
Now, Elmo, the other big development is that you have released a Bluegrass Christmas CD this year. Tell us about that.
Well, for 30 years I've been doing grandma-related and funny songs, and I've gotten a lot of less than stellar reviews. You know, one of the reviews I got said that my music was the bullet train to musical suck. And so with this new bluegrass album, I've actually gotten some nice reviews.
You think people just have a softer spot for the instrumental because they don't have to hear your vocals?
I'm pretty sure they do. I don't know if it was my voice or the lyrics, Peter. It could have been a combination of both.
Well, let's see here. I've just loaded the Bluegrass CD into the machine here. And let's see. Let's listen to the, I guess it's number 11 here. This is the instrumental version of Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. Right now, driving along in Seattle and humming the words to themselves as they listen to that bluegrass rendition. And so what is next for Dr. Elmo? I know you run marathons every year, and at Christmas time you're very busy touring the country and entertaining all your fans. What else are you doing?
Well, I'd like to be able to run the New York Marathon this coming year, get back in shape. And, that would be one of my goals. And maybe do another bluegrass album this year.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great. Non-Christmas one.
Yeah. Well, Elmo, thanks for checking in. I know you've been running crazy on the East Coast, and you made a side trip to New Jersey today. You survived that, I take it.
I'm in New Jersey right now.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I'm in Jersey now.
Well, I hope that they'll send the limo back and at least get you back to New York to your hotel so you can catch a flight back to the West Coast tomorrow.
Well, we're looking forward to coming back. We're sort of homesick right now.
All right. Well, Dr. Elmo, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you late night tonight with Jimmy Fallon on ABC.
All right, Peter, it was wonderful to be on with you. I love our tradition together.
Merry Christmas, my friend.
Merry Christmas.
All right, there he goes, Dr. Elmo, the guy who sings Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. And by the way, all his music is available at his website, drelmo.com. And if you go to iTunes, shop carefully, because there's an ancient, ancient version of the song that's listed under Elmo and Patsy. That's not the one you want. You want the fresher version that just says Dr. Elmo. Kathy and David, little Chloe, and me, Peter B. Collins, wish you a Merry Christmas.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe she'd been drinking too much eggnog, and we begged her not to go. But she forgot her medication, and she staggered out the door into the snow. When we found her Christmas morning at the scene of the attack, she had hoof prints on her forehead and incriminating claws marks on her back. Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now we're all so proud of Grandpa. He's been taking this so well. See him in there watching football, drinking beer and playing cards with Cousin Mel. It's not Christmas without Grandma. All the family's dressed in black, and we just can't help but wonder, should we open up her gifts or send them back?
Send them back!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now the goose is on the table and the pudding made of fig.
Ah!
And the blue and silver candles that would just have matched the hair in Grandma's wig. I warned all my friends and neighbors, better watch out for yourselves. They should never give a license to a man who drives a sleigh and plays with elves. Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Sing it, Grandpa!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Merry Christmas.